the founder and director of the Jerusalem Center for Communication and Advocacy Training. Please give your attention to our featured speaker, David Olesker.
It just struck me that you mentioned that for the election you have tablets out there. At one point, two tablets were enough for the whole Jewish people. Now we all have our own. I've been very ably introduced. My name is David Olesker. As you've probably gathered from my accent, I'm Israeli. I'm a recovering Englishman. I've lived in Yerushalayim for most of my life, Baruch Hashem. And I've been involved in this area of Israel advocacy for more than three decades. And one of the things that that becomes very clear to you is that in order to be an effective advocate, you really have to deal with three areas, two of which we're going to deal with tonight. The successful advocate needs information, needs skills in order to turn information into advocacy, and needs a forum within which to advocate. Now, what we're going to look at tonight are the first two. So we're going to have two sessions. The first one is going to be looking at content, information. Then we'll take a little break. Maybe if we're all feeling a bit frum, we'll daven Maariv. And then in the second session, we're going to look at technique, how to turn information into advocacy. And the forum issue, you know, maybe that'll come up in the Q&A, maybe it won't come up. That's not really what I'm focused on here this evening. Okay, that's the shape of things to come. The interesting thing about advocacy for Israel is that you meet all kinds of very interesting people in this work. Some of them very bright. And a huge proportion of them mind-bogglingly ignorant about Israel and the Middle East. Frank Luntz, one of the leading focus group pollsters here in the United States, did a series of focus group polls on elite university students here in the United States, Ivy League undergraduates and postgraduate students from a number of different campuses. The things he discovered were astonishing. Half of them thought Israel had been founded recently by America. Right? A third of them believed that Israeli soldiers routinely and as a matter of policy rape Palestinian Arab women. Half of them didn't know that Palestinians are Arabs. Well, what are they then? Aren't they Palestinians? Well, what language do you think they speak? Don't they speak Palestinian? You're talking about the best educated young people in the United States. And when it comes to this particular subject, which is so often in the forefront of the news, they're now garnished, to use a technical term. So, and I think it makes sense if we start by dealing with a very basic piece of information, which is what the conflict is about. I'll talk about college campuses because they're sort of the bleeding edge of Israel advocacy. That's where you encounter the most radical anti-Israel arguments. It's where you encounter the most dedicated pro-Israel advocates. And if you were to walk onto almost any of the campuses here in the city, and you're gifted with many of them, and you were to stop 10 people at random, they can't be Jews, they can't be Arabs, they can't be Jews, they can't be Muslims. And you took 10 people who didn't fall into those categories and say to them, what is the Middle East conflict about? Well, the first thing would be they would know which conflict we're talking about, despite the fact that there's, I think, around more than 20 conflicts going on in the Middle East at the moment. The only one that gets the brand name recognition is the conflict involving Israel. So that's what they would assume you were talking about. What would they answer you in terms of what's about? What would most of them answer you? I should point out that I don't do rhetorical questions. If I ask you a question and you don't answer, it's going to be a very, very slow evening because there'll just be long, quiet pauses.
Apartheid?
Be careful about pronouncing that properly. Now, I'll tell you why, because it's a cheap trick. I've done it so many times. When people say Israel's an apartheid state, I say, you obviously are a great expert on the subject, can't even pronounce the word properly, right? And you've destroyed them. We'll talk about that more when we talk about technique. No. Most people in this country will not say that it's about Israeli apartheid, because most Americans are supportive of Israel. They know there's a conflict. So what would they say it's about?
Israel is occupying and preventing the Palestinians from having their own state.
Well, if you'd taken the four Uber drivers that I had in Pittsburgh last week, they would not have said that. I had four non-Jewish Uber drivers, all of whom had served in the US military. Three of them wanted to know if there was a way they could come to Israel and fight for the Jews. One of the problems that we have is we think the situation in this country is much worse than it is. Because we're exposed to anti-Israel arguments through hostile media, or we move in certain kind of circles where we meet people who are anti-Israel. We just don't meet the vast bulk of Americans who are very pro-Israel. You know, if you go into what people some of them kindly call flyover country, the places you fly over when you're going from one state, one coast to the other. I was in Atlanta, you know, walking into a supermarket in Atlanta. Hi, Rabbi, how's it going? Everyone calls me Rabbi. I'm not a rabbi, but, you know. In all my time in the United States, I have only once encountered a hostile comment on the street. And someone who grew up in Britain, that's a very, very, very different kind of environment. Okay, so it's not oppression, it's not occupation, it's not apartheid. We're talking about ordinary people, normal people. What would they say? Louder?
Clannish.
Colonialism?
Clannish. No, clannish. Very clannish.
Clannishness? No.
See, maybe it's about land.
Yes. It's about land. That is how most ordinary, reasonable people would see this conflict. And that's why it's a problem. Because it's a very plausible way of looking at it. Much more plausible than, you know, shouting out extreme slogans like apartheid and clannishness and all these negative things. If you say that it's about land, that's something that people are familiar with. And if you have a conflict over land, over territory, then what's the obvious way to solve it? Right? First mission in Babylon, Sia, Steinmachs in Batalis. Two people come in front of a Bastion holding a talis. What do you do? They both claim it. Divide it in two. It is so seductive that even very, very bright people, even people in very high positions, even perhaps people in the highest position in the land, can accept it. Without malice. Yeah, if it was limited to these kind of very negative, extreme anti-Israel positions, it wouldn't be so dangerous. If it's about land, then obviously the solution is to draw a line on the map somewhere. You know, we can argue about exactly where the line should be, but obviously the line has to be drawn on the map. And since Israel's in control of all of the land, it must be Israel that has to give stuff up. I mean, it just doesn't make sense otherwise, does it? That is the plausible, seductive, reasonable sounding explanation that is totally wrong. And I know it's wrong. Because I live in Yerushalayim, and I teach, I don't teach Torah, there are people better qualified than me to teach Torah. I teach public speaking to people going into the rabbinate. First thing I teach them is, if someone says you speak like a rabbi, it's not a compliment. I teach public speaking, and I teach them other stuff as well, including Israel advocacy. And I teach in a place called Or Sameach, which some of you may have heard of. Or Sameach is situated on something that's referred to in the media as the Green Line. You heard of the Green Line? What's the Green Line? Yeah.
It's not exactly, but mostly runs along the armistice line in the during the war of independence in 1949, when they actually did take a green marker and mark it out on a map.
Right, absolutely. It is the old ceasefire line. It's a ceasefire line from the end of from the War of Independence. The idea of there being the 67 borders is a misnomer. There were no borders, there were ceasefire lines. It's a 1949 ceasefire line. And as you pointed out, it was actually drawn with a green grease pencil on a map, on a rather small-scale map. And the width of the line on the map actually translated quite a physically significant area on the ground, which was no man's land. And that's why Or Sameach is built on the Green Line, because after 67 that land was really cheap, and that's always where yeshivas are built. So I was teaching this session in Yeshiva Or Sameach in Yerushalayim, and it's a perfect place to teach it, because if you come out of Or Sameach and you hang a left, you're going into what the media calls East Jerusalem, what was Jordanian-occupied Jerusalem before 67. And if you hang a right, you're going into what was Israeli-controlled Jerusalem before 1967. And incidentally, there's some very interesting distinctions between the two. If you go to the right, you're going into the Shmuel HaNavi neighborhood. And that used to be a very poor neighborhood. I think what you would call over here projects, public housing, what's called in Hebrew blokim, not classical Hebrew. And very interesting, the blokim have no windows facing towards the Green Line. They have walls made out of reinforced concrete, because you're always in fear of snipers from the Jordanian side and possibly mortar fire. You go to the Arab side, there's no fortifications because they weren't afraid of being fired on by Jews. Part of the asymmetry of this conflict. But the point is, there was a line on the map. And the line is in the place where, you know, Mr. Obama and a whole bunch of other people think it should be again. I want someone to explain something to me. If there was a line on the map, if the territory was divided and there was still a conflict, what makes you think that the conflict is going to be ended by drawing a line on a map? You know, I think that's a fairly basic question. And I think it's a bit of a no-brainer, but clearly the conflict is not about territory per se. So it begs the question, what is it about? So that's what I'm going to try and tackle in this session. Now, any Sfardim here? Any? Oh, good, right. I daven by Sfardim every Friday night, because they daven like they mean it. And one of the interesting things about Sfardim is there are no Frei Sfardim, no secular Sfardim. There are more religious Sfardim and there are less religious Sfardim, but there are no secular Sfardim. They don't exist. first thing I want you to grasp in understanding what I'm going to be saying next is that Arabs are Sfardi Goyim. Right? There are no, or all, significant, statistically insignificant numbers of secular Arabs. They don't exist. So when you're looking at the culture of the Arab world, you're looking at things that have been fundamentally affected by Islamic thought. Now, this evening's session is not an overview of Islam. If you heard that there was a guy going around, you know, Catholic churches giving 1 hour lectures on Judaism, you'd know the guy's a joker. Because you can't begin to address Yiddishkeit in an hour. It's too complicated. Well, Lahavdil, and I'll be saying Lahavdil a lot tonight, Lahavdil, Islam is like Judaism. It's not exactly true. Islam is sort of like Judaism on steroids. You know, we daven 3 times a day, they daven 5 times a day. We have Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, they have Ramadan. It's like many analogous concepts to Jewish thought, but, you know, pumped up. But it gives us an insight into it, which I think Christians have a great deal of difficulty in gaining. It's very hard for Christians to understand really what Islam is about. Anybody seen this thing? It circulates on the internet every year in December. Hilchus Christmas. Some Bacho had too much time on his hands and sat down and wrote it. You know, what if Christmas was a Jewish holiday? Yeah. And it's supposed to be a page from the Mishnah Berurah. Yeah. All trees are kosher except the palm tree, which we know from this pasuk, and it quotes the pasuk, isn't really called a tree. You know? And the tree can't be more than a stream amas high, because otherwise you don't have sholat ayin on the fairy on the top. But the fairy is only a b'dievet, not a chilek. It goes on like this. You know? For us, that's religion. And for Muslims, Islam, like Judaism, is a religion of law. It's also, therefore, a religion of machlokes. They've historically settled their machlokes as different ways than we have, but it's still a religion of machlokes, which is important when talking about Islam, because it means Islam's something of a moving target. Almost anything that you can say about Islam, a Muslim can turn around and say, no, that's not true, because my Ayatollah paskens differently. And he's sincere. He's not, you know, pulling tricks on you. Islam is a whole range of different ideas about a lot of different things. So really the only way for someone from the outside to look at it is from a sort of sociological perspective. Islam is what Muslims do. And that's what we're going to look at now, and only at a very, very narrow aspect of Islamic thought and action. The aspects that have an effect on this conflict. Yeah, Islam, again, lahavdil, it affects every aspect of a person's life, just like Yiddishkeit affects every aspect of our lives. What you wear, what you eat, what time you get up in the morning, every aspect of your life is affected by it. And therefore we can't seriously try and look at all of it tonight. I want to focus on just a few very, very narrow aspects of it. Let's start with a basic question. According to Muslims, who was the first Muslim?
Muhammad?
No. Not Abraham. Not Ishmael. Who? What? Adam or Ishan? Adam, the first man. Well, wait a minute, come on. Islam as a religion is only like 1,500 years old, and Adam Marishan was a bit before that. How do you get off saying Adam Marishan was the first Muslim? Well, to answer that, you have to ask the question, what's a Muslim? What does the word Islam mean?
Submission.
Submission to what?
God.
Right. A Muslim is someone who is submitted to the will of God. So how does a human being know the will of God? Sits cross-legged in a cave and says, oi, you know, that's the Jewish mantra. They daven? No. Davening is men talking to God.
Prophecy,
that's God talking to man. Prophets. It's not just Jews who love prophets. Who was the first prophet? Adam Arishon. You know, open up Sefer Bereishis. The Rebbe Shlom talks to Adam HaRishon. That makes him a prophet. And that makes him the first Muslim. Not a very good Muslim. He didn't entirely obey the will of God, but he was the first Muslim. And he, as the first Muslim prophet, is followed by a whole series of other Muslim prophets. Nebi Ibrahim. Many words in Arabic are almost identical to the same word in Hebrew. Nebi is Navi. Right? I've been to Nebi Samuel. Then Keva Shmuel Hanavi. Actually, there's two Kvorim, one for Shmuel Aleph and one for Shmuel Bet. there you go, there's two Kvorim, right? Nebi Ibrahim. Who's Nebi Ibrahim? Abram Avinu, right? Followed by that other well-known Muslim prophet, Nebi Musa. Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Coming up quickly on the outside, Nebi Daoud, who wrote to Tehillim, right? And then you get to Nebi Issa. Oto Ish, the founder of Christianity. According to Muslims, unlike Christians who believe he was God, Muslims do not believe he was God. They believe that he was a prophet, a man who received prophecy. And the story ends, excuse me, from the Muslim perspective, with Muhammad. Muhammad, they call him in Arabic, the seal of the prophets. Which means there's no more prophecy after him, and anyone who says there is prophecy after him, he's an apikoiris. Now, why do we need to know this stuff? We need to know it because it tells you that from a Muslim perspective, Islam is the primordial religion of mankind. The center of the Arabic film industry is Egypt. That's their Hollywood. So I once happened to see on Jordanian television, when I was first in Israel and they only had one channel, you could pick up Jordanian TV in Jerusalem. So I watched one night when I was bored the Egyptian movie of the Ten Commandments. And it's a great movie. It doesn't have Charlton Heston and God doesn't speak in an English accent, but it's still a good movie. It's got everything in it. It's got the Esamakas. It's got staffs turning into serpents. It's got Yetziat Mitzrayim. All the Jews leave Mitzrayim with a cast of thousands, and they come to Yamsuf, and Paro's chasing after them in his chariot with all his army, and there's Krias Yamsuf with all the special effects, and Paro goes forward from his soldiers. They obviously hold from the Rashi that Paro didn't go into the sea, and all the soldiers go into the Yamsuf, and the water closes over them, and they're all drowned. And Paro looks up into the camera and says, "There is no God but Allah." Right? So you got Paro on one side of the Yamsuf. Who's on the other side? The Muslims. Who were the Jews? Because at that time, the only Muslims in the world were Jewish. Yes, I did just say that. Yeah, understand, to be a Muslim is to submit to the will of God. The Jews were the only people at that time submitting to the will of God. Therefore, the Jews were Muslims. Sounds weird, but from their perspective, it makes perfect sense. And what happened to those good Jewish Muslims? When I did Ulpan, years ago when I moved to Israel, I had a very interesting Ulpan class. I walk in the Ulpan class, there's a nun sitting there in the full lavush, you know. And most of the people in the Ulpan class were Goyim. There was a nun, there was a Polish Catholic theologian, a bunch of Armenians, about a third of them were Arabs. The Arabs I understood because the Hebrew was useful to them for professional reasons and whatnot. A very weird class, a very interesting class. The Ulpan teacher had this strategy for teaching Hebrew. She would introduce the most insanely controversial issues for discussion, like, whose country is this? And you could say whatever you wanted to, but you had to say it in Hebrew. It was very motivating. One day in our Ulpan class, the Ulpan teacher says, I'm cancelling class tomorrow because it's a Muslim holiday, and it doesn't make any sense to have class if a third of the people aren't going to be here. Mahmoud, tell the class what holiday it is. So Mahmoud stands up, and in reasonably good Hebrew, explains that it's Eid al-Adha, the last day of Ramadan, also called Eid al-Karban, the feast of the sacrifice. And it commemorates, says Mahmoud, the day when God called upon Abraham to take his son up onto the mountaintop and sacrifice him. He bound his son on the altar, he had the knife poised at his throat, and an angel appeared and said to Abraham, 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 don't harm Ishmael. Right? So the Ulpan teacher, who wasn't particularly from, says, look, I don't want to get in a fight with you, but you'll agree that our Torah is older than your Quran. And he says, yeah. She says, well, you know, in our Torah, it doesn't say it was just Ishmael. It says it was Yitzhak. So he says, yes, that's a typographical error. So he's being diplomatic. What they believe is we changed it. In the original Torah we received on Har Sinai, it said Ishmael, and for our own nationalistic reasons, we edited it, took Ishmael out, and put in Yitzhak. In other words, we corrupted the Torah. It's a very important point. We received a real, authentic divine revelation, but we, the Jews, corrupted it. And what that meant was that God had to have a second try. So he sent another prophet, Nebi Issa, the founder of Christianity, who gave a new revelation that the Christians then corrupted. They invented all kinds of ridiculous things that God would never have said, like love your neighbor like yourself. And therefore, their corrupted revelation had to be replaced by a final, perfect revelation, which came through Muhammad. Right? Think of it like Microsoft. They keep releasing different versions of the software. Every time they find a fault in it, they fix the bugs. You get, you know, Islam 3.0 and Islam 95, and finally you get Islam 8. You know. So today, the only way to be a Muslim is to follow the teachings of Muhammad. By the way, it's interesting. It's a big thing by them that Muhammad was illiterate. Couldn't read or write. And therefore, it's a big nace that the Quran was written down, because he couldn't read or write. The Malak Gavriel, Jibril in Arabic, appeared to him and said, recite. Quran is Loshon Koire. Another of those words that are very similar in Hebrew and Arabic. So, you understand the historical progression. You start out with Adam Arishon, and you end up with Muhammad. Islam is what every human being is supposed to follow. Every human being is supposed to be a Muslim, which today means following the teachings of Muhammad, which are partially written down in the Quran, and also they have lahabdul their Torah Shebal Peh, what's called the Hadith, the things that Muhammad said that weren't part of the Quran, like, for example, the famous Hadith, the day of judgment will not come until Muslims fight the Jews and kill the Jews, and every rock and stone will shout Abdullah. Abdullah is Avadia in Arabic. Servant of God, come, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him. Except for, it names a certain species of tree, which is the tree of the Jews that will try to hide them. And therefore it's a big mitzvah by Muslims to uproot this tree wherever they see it, because they're waiting for, you know, Sefer Yamim. They don't want any Jews getting away. That's one of the Hadith. So, everybody ought to be a Muslim. What about people who aren't Muslims? You know, the world divides in a binary way very easily between Muslims and non-Muslims. So who are the non-Muslims? Well, there's a few categories of them. There's the idolaters, the Obdei Avodah Zarah. I grew up in Britain. I had a lot of Hindu friends. Hindus are very religious people. They worship everything. Cows, elephants, you know, cats, you name it. They worship everything. It's Mamash Avodah Zarah. And that's why, historically, there's been this tremendous conflict between the Muslim world and India, down to the present day, between India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. So, Obdei Avodah Zarah, idolaters, have no place in a Muslim world. What about monotheists who aren't Muslims? Well, if there are monotheists who believe in a religion that began after Islam, then there are Bikursim. The Baha'is. Visited Israel, you must have gone to the Baha'i Gardens in Haifa. Everybody goes to the Baha'i Gardens. Nobody knows what they are. They're the headquarters of the Baha'i world faith, which is the most inoffensive religion in the world. Their motto is, "We are all flowers in one garden." You know? Right. Totally inoffensive people. Incredibly persecuted throughout the Muslim world. Because their prophet, the Bab, like in Baba Basra, Baba Metzia, Baba Kama, the Bab is after the time of Muhammad. And therefore they're Apikorsin. There's no prophecy after Muhammad. Or the Sikhs, the guys with the turbans who seem to all own all the 7-Elevens here. Right? I grew up with Sikhs in England. I had a lot of Sikh friends as well. I was in a taxi once in Toronto on my way to speak on campus. And the taxi driver was a Sikh. So he says to me, "So tell me, sir, what brings you to Toronto?" And I said to him, I'm here to speak on campus. He says, "Oh, what about?" I said, I'm speaking about the situation in the Middle East today. He says, "Oh, good, you're speaking against the Muslims." So I said, "Well, you know, I wouldn't quite have put it in those terms." He says, "You don't have to play games with me. I understand." Our Guru Nanak, the founder of their religion, says, "Our Guru Nanak taught us that if you were to smear your arm with oil and insert it into a container of sesame seeds, when you withdrew your arm, the number of seeds adhering to your skin would be less than the number of lies a Muslim tells in one day." The political correctness has not caught on with these guys, right? Considering that one of their five mitzvahs tamidi is to carry a knife, I'm very glad they're on our side. You know? These guys have fought against the Muslim world for centuries. And won most of the time. Very interesting people, the Sikhs. There's an interesting religion. There's like two levels of membership in the Sikh religion. There's the regular Sikhs and there's the admitted Sikhs. And you have to go through a special ceremony and take exams to become an admitted Sikh. And the admitted Sikhs are supposed to be vegetarians. They're not allowed to eat meat. They're allowed to eat meat if it's pikuach nefesh. If there's nothing else to eat and they're going to starve, they're allowed to eat meat. Right? With one exception. Horog v'lo yavo. They're supposed to die rather than eat halal meat. Right? That tells you a lot about the historical relationship between Sikhs and Muslims. Right?
Is kosher meat still okay?
I don't think they've quite got a handle on that yet. You know? I asked one of them about it. He says, yeah, he had to ask somebody who was an expert. He didn't know. He's going to ask his local Rav. You know? So, they're very interesting people. And, when I was a student in Britain, we had all kinds of strategic alliances with the Sikhs. They, it gives you something, again, like a just side point, idea of their culture. They called their student organisation the British Organisation of Sikh Students, BOSS. those kind of guys you're dealing with, right? So those, you know, the Baha'is, Sikhs, they're apikorsim, they're chayav misa, right? They have no right to live in a Muslim society. Who does have the right to live in a Muslim society? Well, Muslims, obviously. But also what's called al-kitab. People of the book. People with scriptures. Or as Jewish fundraisers call them, people of the checkbook. Jews and Christians. Adherents of the early release versions of Islam. Because they're following a divine revelation, they have a scripture. May have been corrupted, may not be as good as the ones the Muslims have, but they're not either apikorsim or avdei avodah zarah. They're people who are following divine revelation. And therefore, Jews and Christians have a special status in Muslim societies, what's called dhimmi. Dhimmi is a hard word to translate into English. Batya Orr, the woman who literally wrote the book on this subject, uses the French word protégé. Am I pronouncing that properly? They are people who have a protected status under Islam, which means you can't kill them. A Jew or a Christian living in a Muslim society has the right to live, has the right to practice their religion, has the right to engage in a profession, to work, own property, on condition they subjugate themselves to Muslims. That's what it means to be a dhimmi. And that was the traditional status of Jews in Muslim societies, Christians as well. Now, Christians had a big problem with it because, you know, Christianity was the dominant religion in Europe and increasingly in the rest of the world. So Christians felt they ought to be in charge. Jews had much less of a problem with it because, you know, what else was on offer? You could go to Europe and be burnt at the stake. Or, you know, if you got lucky, you didn't have to, you know, schlep out to the stake. You'd be burnt in your synagogue. What's the basis of Christian anti-Semitism? What's their big tiner against us?
We killed Jesus,
right?
Yeah.
Right, because he wouldn't be a doctor. Old Lenny Bruce routine. Very old Lenny Bruce routine. And who was Otto Aish, according to them? According to the Christians?
A Jew.
No, not just, much more than that.
Mashiach.
Not just Mashiach. He was God! Jews have this whole mishigas about he was a son of God. You know, it's like a sequel to Godzilla, you know. Right? Son of Godzilla 2. Right? Christians believe that Otto Aish was God. And the Jews killed him. The Jews can kill God? Whoa, scary Jews. The Jews are powerful and frightening. That's the basis of Christian anti-Semitism. Look at the whole history of Christian anti-Semitism. Jews are in league with the devil. Jews spread the plague. Jewish doctors murder their patients. The protocols of the elders of Zion. The blood libel. Jews murder babies to use their blood for baking matzah. That's why it's so expensive. Right, especially the Mahadran ones. And it's all about power and fear. Muslim anti-Semitism is fundamentally different. Muslim anti-Semitism is about contempt. When the armies of Muhammad rode out of Mecca and Medina and conquered the Arabian Peninsula, they conquered a series of independent city-states, most of which were Arab city-states, but a few of which were independent Jewish city-states. One of them was a city called Kabir. And the Muslim historians tell the story of Kabir, that the Muslims massacred the Jewish population of Kabir because they refused to submit. And there's one part of the story that always rings very true to me. One of Muhammad's generals spotted that one of the leaders of the Jews had a beautiful glima, beautiful robe. And he promised himself he would take it off this Jew's dead body after he'd killed him. And he did. And discovered the Jew had made lots of holes in it, you know. You might be able to kill me, but you're not getting my Shabbos suit, you know. I'm sure that's the way a Jew thinks. Yeah. I'm going to get you in the end. My son is an officer in the Israeli army. And the Arabs scream at him, Kabir, Kabir al-Yahud, Jayish Muhammad Bafatah. Kabir, Kabir, O Jew, the army of Muhammad is at the gate. Today, they're telling us, we beat you and we'll beat you again. There's a saying in Arabic, if the Muslims spat on the Jews would drown. Hell of a lot of Muslims, not many Jews. Muslim anti-Semitism is all about contempt. So if you're a Jew in Europe, a member of a powerless minority that was feared, you were in tremendous danger. You go to the Muslim world, you're a Nebuch. Nebuchs are not in danger so much. That's why Jews, who have a highly developed sense of the difference between the frying pan and the fire, fled the Western world for the Muslim world, where you could at least live. And Jews thrived in the Muslim world as long as we were willing to submit.
Which means what exactly in that context?
It means a whole variety of things. It means systematic humiliation. Laws to keep you humiliated. The yellow badge. That was a Muslim invention. Long before the Nazis ever thought of it. Yellow badges for Jews, blue badges for Christians. Particularly so in Shia society. The Shia believe in Tuma and Tahara. And a non-believer is a source of Tuma, so you have to keep away from him. The ghetto, or Mela, as it's called in Arabic. The designated area where the Dhimmis had to live. Muslim invention. If you were a Jew, you couldn't ride on a horse, you could only ride on a donkey. If you're a Muslim, you could carry a sword. If you're a Jew or a Christian, you could only have a stick. The roof of your house of worship couldn't be higher than the nearest mosque, right? There are some parts of it that have a kind of sense to it. Because the nature of the Muslim state was, it was a Muslim state and it existed to spread Islam and to defend Islam. Theoretically, no non-Muslim could hold public office. They made exceptions at different times in history when they needed particular individuals. They found a heter, you know. But for most of history, non-Muslims couldn't hold public office or even serve in the army. Because the purpose of the army was to wage jihad. Either offensive or defensive jihad. There was an exception in the time from the time of the Ottoman Turks onwards because they needed big modern armies and they conscripted everybody into it. So you meet people today who's, you know, I met a guy at the Skokie Yeshiva this morning. His grandfather had been in the Ottoman army. He'd been conscripted. But that was in the old days when they were from, they didn't do that. So the army provides for everyone's defence, not just the Muslims. So if you're not serving in the army, what's your contribution to national defence? You have to pay a special tax, the jiash, which Muslims didn't have to pay. Only dhimmis had to pay. So you can hear, it seems to make a certain kind of sense. Until you get down to the nitty-gritty of how it worked. It was a communal tax, so the chief rabbi was in charge of collecting it from the Jews. Whoever the chief galach was in any particular area was supposed to collect it from the Christians. And he was personally responsible for bringing in the cash, and if he didn't, he, you know, would meet with surgical consequences. He usually came up with the money. Jews are good at that kind of thing. Jews always contribute. And the ceremony where it was handed over would typically run like this. The Muslim official would sit in an elevated position, and the Jew would come in bent-backed with the bag of money, which he would present to the Muslim official, who would spit on him and slap his face. Now, if it was a good year, you could slip the guy a little bit of gelt, and he'd just give you a tap. If it was a bad year, and the guy was so frumped, he'd knock your teeth out. And that was better than Christian Europe. Humiliation. Systematic humiliation. That was the life of the Jews in the Muslim world. But at least you could live. Total digression. Just tell you a story, because it's a great story. I met a guy who had been in China, in the backwoods of China, not in the big cities. And it had come up in conversation with his host that he was Jewish. This guy had never even met a Jew, never even seen a Jew on television, you know, which had happened in China, you know. And he says to the Jewish guy, he says, "Oh, you're Jewish? In my language, we have a proverb about your people." So my friend was very interested. What is the proverbial knowledge of the Chinese about the Jews? He says, in my language, we say, if a Jew jumps out of the window, jump out after him. The one thing the Chinese know about the Jews, and the Chinese are not stupid, is the Jews know when it's time to leave. If you see the Jews leaving, don't even ask why they're going. Just follow them, right? Because I'll say, Chochma Begoyim Tamin, right? To believe that the non-Jews have Hachma. So, let's pull together what we've talked about so far. Islam, the primordial religion of mankind. Everybody ought to be a Muslim today. The only people who get out of the obligation are Christians and Jews, who are already sort of quasi-Muslims anyway. They're Yotzi. As long as they submit to the rule of real Muslims. They get uppity, then they have to be slapped down. That's the demography of it. Let's talk about geography. There's a flag on your handout. Did you get these handouts? These one-page ones?
No.
I said, get them afterwards. It doesn't matter. So you'll get them before you leave. That's a map of... That's the flag of Saudi Arabia. It's a green flag. Green is the colour of Islam. And what's on the flag is this beautiful calligraphy, is the Shahada, the testimony. It's Lahavdil Ver Shema Yisrael. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger. And that's what Saudi Arabia says to the world. You know, we're a Muslim country. We believe in this. Oh, and by the way, here's a sword. That's the other thing on the flag of Saudi Arabia. The Arabian Peninsula is where the Muslim religion began. And it spread out along the edge of the sword. At least in the Middle East. What was the dominant religion in the Middle East before the rise of Islam?
Christianity?
Yes.
What?
Christianity. Christians don't know that. I was teaching a Christian group about 2 weeks ago, just before I took this trip. I asked them the same question. Not one of them knew. In one of the big franchises that the Catholic Church has, you know, we always have a school somewhere called Beis Yaakov, right? They always have a school called St. Augustine's. It's one of the big franchises. So, yeah, where did St. Augustine come from? St. Augustine of Hippo. Hippo is in Tunisia. The Middle East was Christian, apart from the bits that were Jewish. Until Muhammad's armies rode over them and subjugated them. Now, that created what's called in Arabic the Dar al-Islam. Dar is Lashon Dira, the home of Islam. I had a map of the world that I got from the Iranian consulate. And I wish they'd had this map when I was doing geography in high school, because it would have made everything so much easier. The oceans are blue, and the landmass is coloured in only two colours, green and black. So green is the Dar al-Islam. black is the Dal Hab. Hab is Cherev, the house of war, the places that are not yet Muslim. So on that map, what colour would Syria be?
Green.
Green, correct. Right. What colour would Switzerland be?
Black.
Right. What colour would Libya be?
Green.
Green. What colour would the United States be?
Black.
Not just DC, but the whole country, right? What colour would Ireland be?
Black,
for once it's not green, right? What colour would Portugal be? Green. Why would Portugal be green?
Because it used to be part of Dar al-Islam.
Right. And it's like Hektesh. Once it's part of the Dar al-Islam, it's always part of the Dar al-Islam. Spain and Portugal, green on that map. Osama bin Laden in his first video, sounds like a rock star, right? Calls on Muslims to rise up and liberate Al-Andalus, the Arabic name for for Spain and Portugal. Andalusia, that comes from the Arabic. So the world geographically splits up into the Dar al-Islam and the Dar al-Hab. What colour is Eretz Yisrael on that map?
Green.
Green. And where is it?
No.
It's right in the middle of the Dar al-Islam. Dar al-Islam runs from North Africa and down into Africa, across to the border of China. And right in the geographical middle of it, slap bang, well, bang probably isn't the right word to use in this context, slap in the middle of it is Eretz Yisrael, which is not only part of the Dar al-Islam that is being ruled over by Dhimmis, which is Shatnas. Who are the Dhimmis ruling over? They're ruling over Muslims. That's outrageous. How outrageous is it? Walter Le Cure's book, O Jerusalem, on the War of Independence. Great book to read before Yom Yerushalayim. Tremendous book. It consists of first-hand interviews of all kinds of people involved in the War of Independence. It tells an amazing story about the siege of Jerusalem, where the Jordanian army, which was the best trained army the Arabs had because they had British officers, another great gift of the British to the Middle East, the Jordanian army was shelling the old city. A handful of defenders there. And suddenly this old Arab man in traditional dress with the slippers with the curled up toes, schlepping a First World War antique mortar on his back, turns up. And the Jordanian soldiers ask him, what are you doing here? And he says, I've come to fight the Jews. And they said, where from? He says, I came from Baghdad. They said, how did you get here? He says, I walked. That's Mesiras Nefesh. This guy walked from Baghdad with his First World War mortar on his back to be able to come and kill the Jews. Old man. So they give him cover, he's a Zakane, right? Sets up his mortar, gets out an old First World War mortar shell, gets ready to drop it in, says, Allahu Akbar, drops it in, blows up, all that's left are the slippers. Right? Proof the Abishta has a sense of humour. Right? He walked from Baghdad so he could fight the Jews. You think that was in 1948? There are a couple of British-born Muslims who came from very liberal, moderate families, so much so that the parents of one of them sent him to a Jewish school in London. And they were Chozer B'Tshuva. You know what Bali Tshuva are like. And they went on their British passports to Eretz Yisrael. They recorded a martyr video in English, which you can see, which you don't get to see these in English very often. They went to Eretz Yisrael, and one of them blew himself up in a pub called Mike's Place, which happened to be owned jointly by a Jew and an Arab, killing innocent people. The other one couldn't make it, so, you know, he drowned himself. I suppose you don't see Padilla ever that way. And these guys are not going to be satisfied by drawing a line on a map. And their viewpoint is not some way out, weird position in the Muslim world. It's a position that many, many Muslims can identify with. Now, you know, not all Muslims identify with it. And even of those who identify with it, not everyone's going to go and blow themselves up. But, you know, there is a large proportion who sympathise with it, think it's a good thing. You know, it's not for me. I'm not doing it myself. But they think it's a great idea when somebody else goes out and does it. I want to make a very, very important caveat here. We're Jews, we believe that everybody has bechira, everybody has free choice. And there are certainly Muslims who do not think the way that I've been explaining so far. Ranging from Sheikh Palazzi, who's the leader of the Muslims in Italy. Guys, I've had correspondence with via email. He is a very frum, very orthodox Muslim. He's also a Zionist. He's a Muslim Zionist, right? Now, you've probably not met many of those. But just as there are Christian Zionists who look into their book and feel that it teaches them they have to support the Jews, Sheikh Palazzi looks into the Quran and it says there, leave the Jews alone in the land God gave them. And he says, I have to support Israel. Or you have Irshad Manji, who lives in Toronto. She's a Muslim feminist lesbian. Don't meet many of those either, do you? So interestingly, she's essentially what you might call a reform Muslim. She hasn't disassociated herself from Islam like a lot of people in her position would, but she feels Islam has to change. She wrote a book called The Problem with Islam Today. And her big thing is the women's issue. And she speaks fearlessly about it. And she, one of the things she says, it's not the main thing she says, but one of the things she says is that she's visited Israel. She says Israel isn't the problem in the Middle East, Israel's a solution. If Muslim women in the rest of the Middle East have the same rights that Muslim women had under Israeli rule, not only would the Middle East be safe for women, the world would be safe from the Middle East, because the Middle East would be a different place. Very interesting person. Great person to bring up to speak on a university campus, because, you know, she's a person of colour. She's highly articulate. She's drop-dead gorgeous. She's a woman. She's a feminist. She's a lesbian. No one is allowed to argue with her. She probably checks the vegetarian box as well. She's all there, right? So there definitely are individuals. This guy I know, I know him from the UK, but he lives in Winnipeg now. Kasim Hafiz, another Muslim Zionist. Bridget Gabrielle, you've probably come across. She's actually a Christian, but she comes from a Muslim culture. Thanks to the internet, you know, Yechidim aren't Yechidim anymore. They all connect with each other. So there are a minority of people out there Muslims out there, who really do honestly think very differently from the way I'm talking. I met a guy at the last global conference against anti-Semitism 2 years ago in Jerusalem. A Sufi from Manchester in England, who's very pro-Israel, very from Muslim. We started talking about Haksharim, which Haksharim he could trust in Britain. we got on to talking about the situation and the radicalization of Muslim societies and especially European Muslims. He told me something very interesting. He says to me, do you know who the Grand Mufti of Britain is? I said, I'm sorry to confess my ignorance. I really have no idea. He says he's called Sheikh Google. The average Muslim in Britain or France or Germany is an Emirates. He's had no proper Muslim education. So he wants to know what Islam says about anything. He Googles it. And who owns most of the websites? No, not the Muslim websites. The Iranians and the Saudis. And the Saudis have one of the most extreme and aggressive forms of Islam, what's called Wahhabism. And so, you know, regardless of numbers, you know, and this isn't a democracy, we're not counting, you know, votes for the World Zionist Congress here. The people with the megaphone, the people who make their voices heard, are the extremists. And they are the ones who are saying what I said in this presentation. And they're the ones who are listened to by most Muslims in the world. Why is it important? I said earlier, the land is the issue frame says that it's all up to Israel. Israel's got land, Israel has to give up land, then there'll be peace. I prefer to talk about the apartheid frame. You know, you've heard people talk about apartheid in the Middle East. There is. Against Jews. This is the apartheid against Jews. Jordan, one of the most westernized, liberal Muslim countries, has written into its constitution a Jew can't be a citizen. Apartheid, and I was in South Africa just before the end of apartheid. Apartheid as a legal system rested on an attitude of mind promoted by the Dutch Reformed Church. That black people were inherently inferior to white people. They were the B'nai Ham, and therefore only fitted to be slaves. Yeah, the Christians found one bit of Torah Shebaal Peh that they liked. And as long as white South Africans believed that black South Africans were inherently inferior to them and not entitled to rights, there wasn't very much that black South Africans could do. And if you read Long March to Freedom, everything they tried, you know, from Gandhian non-violent resistance up to terrorism, didn't really help. But at some point, white South Africans changed their mind. And that was the only way any change was going to come. When the white South Africans changed their minds and said, no, you know what? F.W. de Klerk meets Nelson Mandela and says, you know what? He's a mensch. He's smarter than me. He's got gravitas. He's entitled to rights, not because I give them to him, but because he's a human being. At that moment, apartheid fell. But it only fell because white South Africans had to change. Now look what I've done. I've created an entirely different narrative of the Arab-Israeli conflict, in which it's not nothing is on Israel. The Arab world has to change. That is not only a much more helpful narrative for us. If I can quote from what may be an apocryphal story, that there was apparently once an AIPAC briefing going on, and the AIPAC professional was going down a list of talking points, and he came to one and he said, and this argument has the additional advantage of being true. This argument has the additional advantage of being true. This is the emes about the conflict in the Middle East today. And not just the conflict with Israel and the Arab states, the conflict with ISIS, all of these things. And if, you know, more people in positions of power in this country got this, then our job would be a lot easier. Now, that's a lot of complex information. I think I'll take two questions, okay? I saw a couple of hands going up. There's a lady over here. Yeah, you want to ask a question? Okay, lady over here, yeah.
You were saying that...
Loud.
That the Muslims believe that Christianity and Judaism were...
The beta versions of Islam, right?
Right. But then how do they explain the change in God's theory that you should be nice to people and you should...
No, that's the point. That what happened was you know, the Islam that was revealed to the Jews and the Christians was just like the Islam that exists today, but the Jews and the Christians changed it.
Not just the bit about
Yitzhak and Ishmael. They changed the whole of God's teachings, and therefore they corrupted it. Had to be renewed.
So why then?
Progressive revelation.
And they match. They're the same.
In some places, yes. In some places, no.
So
you know, where it matches, that means we didn't change it, and where it doesn't match, it means we did change it. Because they know they've got it right, because they've got the Quran codes that proves that the Quran is true. They have whole seminars on it. Gentleman in the back here, yeah.
Whenever I Google Israel, the name always comes up, Avi Shalem from England.
Avi Shalem, yeah.
I don't know who that is, but he's critical of Israel, but you mentioned Iran and Saudi Arabia. Is there anything on our side that's trying to use Harris Google?
I'm very focused on this issue of training. That's what I do. But there are certainly organizations, I don't want to go into too much detail on the record, that are, you know, there are wiki wars, for example. Anybody can edit Wikipedia. So there are groups of people who go into Wikipedia and put in anti-Israel stuff. And there are groups of people who immediately edit it. The internet actually is a place where we're doing very well. Social media, especially when there's a war going on in Israel. I'll talk about this more in the next session because it's more about technique. But we during Protective Edge and during Cast Lead, we owned social media. The problem is keeping it up when it's peacetime. One more question from over here. Two. This lady, that's it. Yeah.
Okay. As I recall, when we were talking about South African apartheid, the change came after years of external worldwide pressure on the state.
That's true.
It seems like all the worldwide pressure is from the liberal churches and the liberal Jews and the crazy people and the Democrats, which is not the kind of pressure that is going to help Israel.
It's true that there was pressure on South Africa, but it didn't change the fact that South Africa had most of the world's manganese. Right? South Africa was a strong economy. You know, I happened to be there in the dying days of apartheid, and I opened up one of the national newspapers, and they had a whole one-page ad in it. Due to international pressure, IBM is closing in South Africa. And you turn the page, today BMI is opening in South Africa. It was IBM under another name. Right? And, you know, sanctions only work if somebody really, really wants them to work and is going to force them to work. And for all its moral posturing, the international community didn't really... The thing that had more effect was the sporting sanctions, because it affected the morale of South Africans. And that led them partially towards this idea of changing their minds. Yeah?
So, I was very active in the protests this summer, defending Israel. And whenever I would go to these protests, there was always... bunch of people on the other side carrying the Palestinian flag screaming, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Right.
Okay, so right up front, they're admitting this has nothing to do with land.
Right.
They want us out, they want us gone, they want us not there. How do you get somebody like that? Because they're the ones with the megaphones. Like, I understand that I can sit down and have a reasonable conversation with somebody who's, as you put it, undecided on the front. But that's not the person with the megaphone.
Right.
I want...
And at the risk of sounding like I'm fobbing off, that's exactly what we're going to discuss in session two.
Okay.
So I'm going to yield the floor to the break.